This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
For good, and he kept telling me what he was finding about the state of addiction treatment in this country. And it was really disturbing. And I stayed in touch with him over the course of the past 10 years, and he was telling me things like, addiction treatment programs have unqualified professionals. Most of them don't have adequate medical treatment. They don't have psychologists and social workers on staff. Their staff turnover is as high as it is in fast food restaurants. Well, that's not good for patients when staff are coming and going all the time. They're not using science-based treatments. So I really became intrigued with this, and about 5 years ago, when Brittany and Lindsay began hopping in and out of rehab, I got really intrigued and decided to write a book about it. And I thought, you know, the public isn't informed about addiction treatment. Somebody needs to go inside. And I decided to do that. I visited 15 addiction treatment programs all across the country and interviewed more than 100 people who had recently been in addiction treatment. And that became Inside Rehab.
So when you say addiction treatment, you're talking both inpatient and outpatient treatment?
That's correct, and I just use rehab to describe it all, although we usually think of rehab as residential treatment where you go away overnight. Typically think of it as 30 days, although most people need a lot more than that, and we can talk about why that is. But residential treatment, which we usually see people going to on TV, really represents very little of the kind of addiction treatment that goes on in this country. 80 to 90% of it is outpatient, where people are going usually by day or often in the evening for just a couple of hours, a couple of times a week, or sometimes it's more intense than that, but they go home and live at their homes. That's what most of addiction treatment is in this country. And actually, the research studies find it to be, in general, just as effective as residential treatment, and it's a lot less expensive.
So what are some of the current success rates for rehab centers, both inpatient and outpatient?
Well, when you look at it, in general, studies find it to be about 50% over the course of a year. About 50% of people are able to stay abstinent. But the bigger concern that I had is that only about one out of, there's 22 million people in the United States with some kind of serious drug or alcohol problem, and only about one out of 10 get help every year. And that's really, you know, the big concern to me is, why are so few people getting help? And I found that there are a lot of reasons for that, but I found that there are three big concerns, and I'll just address what they are in general. We can come back to them. But one of them is that our treatment in this country tends to be one size fits all. Pretty much everybody, I mean, there's exceptions to every rule, and I did find and visits, and I profile some excellent treatment programs. But in general, addiction treatment tends to be, as Dr. McClellan said to me, if you've seen one treatment program, you've seen them all. And I said, in the beginning, I said, can I quote you on that? And he said, yep. He said, because they pretty much offer the same treatment to everybody. Another big issue, number two, would be that there's a huge gap between what science shows to be effective and what actually goes on in these programs. And number three, the things that we think should protect us don't. I'm talking about credentialing and licensing. People are not necessarily getting what they think they are, not being protected the way they think they are. So we can, you know, talk about some of those things in greater depth.
Well, I'm interested about the lack of science, and I was really fascinated in Inside Rehab about the comparison you make between the current state of addiction centers and the way we used to address people with tuberculosis. Can you talk a little bit more about the corollary you see between those
two?
Well,
that was actually Dr. McClellan's statement. I don't know a lot about tuberculosis treatment, but that was actually in his introduction. But actually, what we find is that most addiction treatment programs say that they're using scientifically backed approaches. And that was one of the questions I asked them as you went around. Are you using cognitive behavioral therapy? There's a number of approaches that, you know, it's the lingo, but we know in scientific studies that they tend to be more effective. Are you using motivational interviewing? That's another one of the buzzwords. There are strategies that help to motivate people to change. And we know they're effective, and everybody says they're using them. But when experts have actually, like Kathleen Carroll, Dr. Carroll is a psychologist at Yale University who's actually gone into programs, and they have trained experts who sit in on sessions where you would think people, the counselors would be at their best behavior, and they measure what's going on in these sessions, or they record them, and they measure how much science-based, or what they call evidence-based treatment is going on. And what they found when they analyzed many, many sessions is that the science-based treatment that's going on is, their words were, the scientists who studied this, where the evidence-based treatment is so rare as to be almost undetectable. They said that a lot of what was going on was chat, C-H-A-T, with their words, checking, and another group is studying this more recently than Dr. Carroll's study, and they're studying what's going on in treatment programs. They said there's a lot of checking in with clients, a lot of winging it, again, their words, not mine, a lot of going to the computer right before group starts and Googling worksheets. So there's not a lot of planning going on. Another thing that surprises people is that, and I observe this because I was allowed to sit in on what was going on in some very expensive programs that are very famous. A lot of what goes on is educational lectures. People sit in these lectures where you learn about the disease of addiction and the 12 steps. And some places, now I didn't see films, but patients reported to me that clients that they watched films like This Is Your Brain on Drugs and This Is What Happens. These things are a mainstay of treatment. Hundreds of studies show that these are among the least effective ways to treat alcohol problems, and they're still going on. Failure to use medications. Only about medications we know that are effective to help people, like with alcohol cravings. Only 2 out of 10 programs nationwide are using FDA-approved medications for helping people with alcohol use disorders.
So, Anne, my question about the fact that all of these treatment centers are basically, in your mind, doing very similar treatments. You could look at one and you could look at most of them. I would think that if there was a ton of science, that we would see more standardization between addiction centers because we would have a lot of data to go on that everyone would be using in the same way. But if there's so little of it's based on science, why aren't all of these treatment centers so different from each other as they sort of develop their own techniques and do their own approaches that aren't science-based?
Well, it's a complicated issue. I mean, you know, a lot of what goes on is, when I talked about the one-size-fits-all treatment, so much of addiction counseling, almost all of it, is group-based. Again, another colorful quote from Dr. McClellan, who really is, you know, I interviewed many, many experts in the field, but he gives very colorful quotes. He said, if you go to just about any addiction treatment in the country, the major treatment activity is group. If that doesn't work, then they'll try group. And when all else fails, they'll suggest group. And many people reported to me of the people I interviewed who went to rehab. And I interviewed people who had been to rehab 5, 10, even 20 times. It's very sad. And some of them had spent literally families, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Some of them had been wiped out. And many people said to me, I just couldn't do it in groups. I was not able to get sober until I went to a program where they really provided a much more individual approach. And I did find a few programs that really offered one-on-one counseling. I found that typically at a high-end residential program, the typical where you're paying $30,000 for a month of treatment, there's some type of group counseling, education, lecture, or other group activity about 8 hours a day. I mean, and that's not including meals. Not only did that seem like quite a heavy load, a lot of what I call seat time for somebody who's just coming off drugs and alcohol, but I would have expected, like let's say as a parent, if I was sending, you know, one of my young adult children to rehab, that there would have been a lot more individual counseling with a doctoral level person. But in fact, people were at some of these places were only getting at most 3 to 5 hours a week of individual counseling. Most of that with a drug and alcohol counselor. Typically, at best, they would have a master's degree. Many of them have a bachelor's degree. We can come back to credentialing in the field. But if you have you would not see a doctoral level person like a psychologist unless you had a co-occurring psych problem like depression or anxiety. And at that, you'd only see that person 1 hour a week. So I would have guessed if I was paying $30,000 for a month of rehab that my loved one would be having a lot more individual therapy or treatment. I found one woman said to me at a very expensive rehab for a month, said I looked around at night and everybody was doing the same homework. So lack of individual assignments. Well, we know addiction is an extremely complex disorder. Everybody with an addiction is not the same, as they're often told. You're all the same. No, they're not. They're extremely different. It's extremely complex. So the other thing is that 7 to 8 out of every 10 programs involve the 12 steps of AA in some way. But AA is great when it works, but we know that 6 to 8 out of 10 people who are encouraged, people with an alcohol problem, encouraged to attend AA while in treatment, will stop attending AA in less than a year, and they're never told about alternatives. And there are alternative support groups like Smart Recovery, Women for Sobriety, getting involved in a church group. And they're just not told about these alternatives. Often I found that treatment professionals didn't even know about them.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to Ann Fletcher, the author of Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. So, Ann, you mentioned AA, and I think that's what most people think of as the primary treatment for alcohol. And you're making the point that if it's not working for someone, things need to be individualized. Are there studies on how well AA does work in general?
Well, there are almost no, just a few randomized controlled trials. It's very hard to study AA because it's anonymous, you know. And people, the other thing that many people don't understand is that AA is not treatment. AA, as it exists out in the community, it's a self-help group. It's, or professionals call it, mutual help group. It's people who are recovering or recovered helping each other. So it's a self-help group. It is not treatment. And it was never meant to be treatment. What happened was that treatment programs, professional programs, or programs that are supposed to be professional, adopted AA as a major form of treatment, lock, stock, and barrel. It was not meant to be used that way. AA, one of its major tenets, is that it is supposed to operate by attraction, not coercion. That was in the founding principles. And so, you know, what happened, what I heard people say over and over again is that I just didn't connect with the philosophy. I didn't get it. I didn't connect with it. But I was blamed when treatment failed. And they would go back to treatment over and over again, and the treatment was not adjusted in any way, but it was largely 12-step based. And, you know, if you think about somebody who has a heart blockage of some sort, and they might be offered multiple options, angioplasty, a stent, bypass surgery, and they have a choice, first of all. People are not often given a choice in addiction. Then if the stent, bypass, or angioplasty doesn't work the first or second time, the doctor doesn't keep using the same treatment over and over again, they switch to something else. But that doesn't happen in addiction, and the patient is blamed when treatment fails. You asked about research. We do know that there is a correlation, now not necessarily cause and effect, but there are many correlational studies that show that people who go to AA, get involved in AA, don't not just showing up at the door, but get involved, get a sponsor, make coffee, connect with AA buddies, do tend to have better outcomes. They tend to remain abstinent. But as I said, most people over time do drop out, and they're not told about other options. Research has not been done on the alternative support groups like Smart Recovery, Women for Sobriety, because money tends to be invested by government studies in AA because there are more of those groups out there. So we just don't know about outcomes. Smart Recovery is based on principles. I don't work for them, but, you know, just so people are familiar with it, they have about 800 groups nationwide. They tend to be based on principles of rational emotive behavior therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is science-based. All of these groups have a presence online, so you can attend online meetings if you can't find one in your community. The point is, if you don't connect, there are alternatives. And I didn't want the book to just be negative, you know, these are all the downsides. There is kind of a call to action in every chapter. There is, this is what you can do. This is if when we're talking about the cost of treatment, which can be very expensive, here's what you can do here for your situation. If you have insurance, if you don't have insurance, here's how you get the best quality treatment for your situation.
And you would you agree with the statement, Anne, that the more individualized the treatment, the higher likelihood of effectiveness? Because it seems like that's the repeating theme in Inside Rehab. When I think about how you can't treat a teenager in rehabilitation or addiction centers the same as an adult, and you can't treat men the same as women, as they have different responses going in and different responses to individual therapies that are happening.
Absolutely. You know, we particularly teenagers, and I have a whole chapter on adolescent treatment. In fact, the experts told me to take it out because it should be a book in itself, and I couldn't possibly address it. But I had to have a chapter on that because I knew that so many parents were desperate to get help for their teens. Unfortunately, there's very little research about adolescents. And there's a tendency, well, what tended to happen was that they just adopted treatment programs for adults, for teenagers. And there's really no evidence that that approach works, to just, you know, send kids to AA meetings. And, you know, in fact, we, you know, kids do better in AA meetings for teenagers if they go to AA, but there isn't much research at all about AA in teenagers. And some experts I interviewed think that's not such a great idea. I mean, we just don't know that much. There are three, I believe there were three science-based approaches, programs for teenagers that look nothing like AA or AA-based treatment for teenagers that were developed at university-type settings that not a single program I visited was using. And I have information. One of them is ACRA. That's an acronym, ACRA, in the book that is available at selected sites across the country. And I talk about how you could find one. And there were two others, but these are few and far between. And it's really a travesty that more programs are not using these approaches. Family-based approaches are extremely important. Marital and family counseling for both. Adult marital and family counseling, family counseling, particularly for teens. There was only one program that I went to that was using evidence-based approaches, that's science-based approaches, for marital and family counseling. There was only one other program that was using true marital and family counseling. Most of them are using what are called psychoeducational family weeks, where you go and you have classes and kind of process groups, but there's no evidence that those are effective. So it's really upsetting. But yes, individual approaches are extremely important, and we see very little of that. Instead, there tends to be an approach that gives the message all addicts are the same. I mentioned that earlier, and it's absolutely not true. They're just as individual as anybody is with any kind of health problem. It's insulting to say that to an addict or an alcoholic.
So you mentioned at the beginning of the program, Anne, that about 50% of people in rehab are still abstinent after a year.
I believe that's the
approximately.
Yep.
And
yep.
That outcomes for inpatient facilities aren't better than people who are doing outpatient.
When you look overall, that's correct.
So,
and some experts I interviewed think that residential treatment should be reserved for a very select minority, people who have failed repeatedly at outpatient treatment or, you know, not been able to get sober, who have severe co-occurring psych problems, who might be suicidal, outpatient helps you deal with the real world.
So my question would be, what do we have any science on how people do who don't do either, who are trying to quit? We have the 50% number of people who are abstinent after a year. We know that inpatient and outpatient might not be that different in terms of outcomes. What about people who do it on their own?
I'm so glad you asked. We should have started there. I have a whole chapter on who needs rehab and who doesn't. In fact, we know that most people with substance use disorders, which would be, you know, the professional word for drug and alcohol problems, never go to rehab, never go to any kind of treatment at all. Most people who overcome drug and alcohol problems either get sober completely on their own, and the example I always use is George W. Bush. He probably met the criteria for an alcohol use disorder, or maybe alcoholism, I don't know. But if you watch, read about his history, as far as we know, he never went to an AA meeting, never went to treatment, but had a pretty serious problem and overcame it on his own. Many, many people do that. So most people overcome alcohol problems in particular completely on their own by going to a self-help group like AA or getting individual treatment. When people ask me, and I have lots of stories of people in the book who overcame a drug or alcohol problem that way. When people say to me, what should be my first course of action if they have a problem, the knee-jerk reaction should not be automatically, I need to go to rehab, I need to go to treatment, as it often is. And I think the media feed that notion. What I suggest, unless somebody is really in a very, very bad state and clearly needs detox and medical supervision, unless, you know, if they're not in that kind of condition, my first suggestion is to consult certainly you should, you know, probably check things out with your physician, but in general, physicians, and I don't mean to be offensive, but I think you'd probably agree with me, physicians, mental health professionals, I happen to be married to one, psychologists, mental health professionals, are not trained to treat addiction. They don't, psychiatrists too, do not know much about addiction. And I tell people, I have a whole section in the book about how you can find somebody who is, because there are certain people who have specialty training in that area. So my first advice is to find somebody who has specialty training in that area. I am a person who had a serious drinking problem. It never occurred to me to go to treatment. Most people with a substance problem, particularly alcohol, are in the mild to moderate category, not the severe category. Alcohol problems and drug problems fall on a wide continuum, mild, moderate, and severe. And most people are in the Most people are in the mild to moderate category. They're people sitting next to you at church, sitting next to you in a synagogue, sitting next to you in your office. They're functioning, but they're not in the severe category. And anyway, my suggestion is that you find a medical, mental health, psychiatric, social worker, somebody like that in your community who may be in private practice, who has expertise with addictions. I can think of several people in my small community right off the bat who are in private practice. They could do an assessment. They could scope out how serious your problem is, determine whether or not outpatient residential treatment would be required, or maybe they could see you individually for help and take it from there to determine what your options would be.
So, Anne, do you have a website you could point our listeners to?
I do. It's www.annemfletcher.com, and there's links to my Facebook page and Twitter there as well. And it's Anne with an E, M, middle initial, Fletcher.
Great. Well, it was great having you on Health Watch today, Anne.
Thanks. I hope it was helpful.
We were talking today with Anne Fletcher, the New York Times bestselling author of Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. If you missed part of today's program or you want to listen to other Health Watch programs, you can do so by going to kboo.fm/healthwatch, or you can search for Health Watch in the iTunes podcast store and download the episodes there. Next, I will be here again on the first Monday of April, and we're doing a special one-hour membership drive special on holistic, comprehensive approaches to depression. And I asked for extra time for that show because it's a particularly good book. So hopefully you guys will tune in and hear an interesting guest on an affliction that affects a lot of people. So stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio continues the broadcast of the 2013 Illahi Lecture Series on Tuesday, March 19th, when we broadcast a talk by John Stauber.
Founder of the Center of Media Democracy, John Stauber is an independent writer, organizer, and activist. He has co-authored 6 books, including the bestsellers Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Trust Us, We're Experts, and New York Times bestseller Weapons of Mass Deception. In 1993, he founded the nonprofit Center for Media and Democracy in Madison.
John will be speaking at the First Congregational Church in Portland, and KBOO will broadcast the talk live at 7 p.m. Tuesday, March 19th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/Illahi2013.
Tune in to KBOO this Friday, March 22nd, from 9 a.m. to noon for a KBOO public affairs special, Saving Main Street from Wall Street. How did Washington abandon Main Street while rescuing Wall Street? How can we save Main Street? And how do we create an economy where everybody wins? Join us as we ask authors and scholars these questions and more on Saving Main Street from Wall Street, what history tells us about the bailout and what we do now. That's this Friday from 9 a.m. to noon, right here on KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In this series, we feature conversations with people who have special insights about health topics as diverse as environmental hazards, new and old medical treatments, and the benefits of universal healthcare. Sometimes we present an informal talk or even a lecture. Doing this program has enriched my life, and I hope it enriches yours. Legislature is meeting from February through June, its regular biennial session this year. Not that the legislators have not been busy over the months before, but during a very fast-paced 5-month period, they managed to consider hundreds of bills and pass at least a handful, including some on health and health care. Some of those submitted are relatively minor and clean up or fine-tune existing laws. If something new is proposed, its sponsors try to at least get it a hearing, and if support for it exists, a floor vote, too. However, if there's insufficient support to provide hope that it will pass, it may never be advanced to the floor. On the very first day of the 2013 legislative session, February 4th, a rally of supporters of universal health coverage for Oregonians converged on the Capitol for a rally, with music, talks by legislators, stories about why such a program is needed, sign waving and cheers. And then many of the 900 or more visitors went inside the Capitol to visit legislators and their assistants. I attended this rally and talked to some first-time visitors who were pleased by the openness of the Capitol and its welcoming atmosphere. The main bill that the rally supported is numbered House Bill 2922, and it would get Oregon on the road to universal health care. House Bill 3260 is a related bill that will require the Oregon Health Authority to conduct or contract for a study of the financial options of a universal health care system and make recommendations of what approach would be a good fit for Oregon. This bill is considered extremely important by Healthcare for All Oregon. At the end of the first week of February, two other groups with priorities that have impacts on health visited the Capitol. One consisted of people who stayed outside on the mall, off the Capitol grounds, mostly. This one got a lot of press because it was a rally against gun control, and many of its supporters carried guns. However, only those with a concealed weapon permit were able to enter the Capitol grounds or the Capitol carrying a gun. Public health research has shown that gun ownership in a household is associated with a risk of suicide and homicide that's elevated about 4 times above those households not having guns in them. So that is one of this rally's connections to health. A second group, the Oregon Public Health Association, also had a presence at the Capitol on February 8. This included displays in the Galleria on the first floor of the Capitol, meetings in Room 50, a press conference, and visits with legislators. I attended the press conference and talked to people at displays, and we'll hear some of the press conference and discussions later. At the press conference, OPHA members presented themes that it would like to see legislators pursue, but it did not introduce or support specific bills.